Welcome to Damn Good Movie Memories with your host, Brian Davis. This podcast is the cure for your long commute and super boring workday. Hey there, it's Brian Davis, and for this week's episode, we're going to do a first. It's a silent film from 1921, It's the Kid. The studio was First National, the release date was February 6, 1921. The running time? Well, the original release running time was 68 minutes. It was then re-released in 1972 at 53 minutes. Of course, it was in black and white, and again, it was silent. Leonard Maltin from his classic movie guide gives it 3.5 out of 4 stars. He writes, Charlie Chaplin's first real feature mixes slapstick and sentiment in a winning combination as the tramp raises a streetwise orphan. It's a wonderful film that launched Jackie Coogan as a major star, and it's easy to see why. Now look, there are many folks out there that will simply avoid films that are in black and white, and even more that would never dream of watching a classic silent film. But those close-minded folks are missing out on some amazing works of art, and in some cases, films that have never been matched. Charlie Chaplin films are the latter. Chaplin was arguably one of the most important filmmakers in the history of cinema. And if you have yet to watch his work, hopefully this episode and future episodes will nudge you to check him out. All right, let's get into the making of the film. So in 1917, Chaplin had a contract to make 8 two-reel comedies in 18 months, and he was behind schedule. And he decided to make his first feature-length film, which was the equivalent of 6 reels. 2 reels was considered a short film, as 1 reel was the equivalent of 10 minutes in length. By the time he made The Kid, Chaplin was not only an actor, but wrote and directed all of his short films. This started in 1914 for him. Chaplin was savvy enough with his film contracts to not only make them financially lucrative, but also retain the rights of his films and the master copies. And this is why his films still look amazing today, and were able to be restored because he personally preserved them so well. Now, the version of The Kid I own, and almost all modern audiences will now view, is the edited 53-minute version that was re-released by Chaplin in 1972, and this cut out 3 scenes from the original film release in 1921. Chaplin also added a score he wrote with Eric James. The 3 scenes that were cut all included Edna Purviance, as Chaplin wanted a stronger focus on the relationship between the tramp and the kid, instead of the struggles of the birth mother who felt major anguish over abandoning her baby. Other cut scenes included her failed relationship with the baby's father. Chaplin at this point was at a crossroads in his career. His 2 previous short films were considered disappointments by critics. They were Sunnyside and A Day's Pleasure. Instead of trying to recreate his past short film success, he decided to take a huge risk and make his first full-length feature film. In addition to his career being at somewhat of a low point, his personal life suffered a major tragedy, as his infant son had died only 10 days before filming began for The Kid. This was Chaplin's first child. In addition, his relationship with his wife Mildred Harris had a rocky marriage, and the couple divorced after filming wrapped. The eventual divorce also affected the editing of The Kid, as it had to be done outside of California studios in order to avoid Harris from potentially using the film in her divorce proceedings against Chaplin. He didn't want the film negatives to be used as assets against him and potentially hold up releasing the film. Now, many historians say the emotion in The Kid was definitely related to Chaplin's personal struggles at the time, along with his troubled childhood, which included a criminal father and his mentally ill mother. Chaplin first saw Jackie Coogan when Coogan was 4 years old performing with his father at the Orpheum Theater in Los Angeles. Chaplin recalled his own vaudeville performances as a child and wanted Coogan as his main co-star in his eventual feature film. According to the reports, Coogan was an excellent mimic, which made him perfect for a Charlie Chaplin film, and he could play off Chaplin exactly how he wanted. Coogan was actually one of the first child star actors. Also, it was Chaplin that nicknamed Coogan Jackie, whose birth name was John after his father. Now, Coogan would go on to be best known to many audiences as Uncle Fester in the original Addams Family TV series in the 1960s. He would also be one of the first child actors to sue his parents over the misuse of his earnings that he made as a child. Coogan had made an estimated $3 to $4 million as a child actor, which was an enormous sum for the 1920s and 30s. When Coogan became an adult attempting to retrieve his funds, it was discovered that his mother and stepfather had squandered his entire fortune. Coogan sued his parents in 1936, but only retrieved a fraction of his initial earnings, somewhere in the $120,000 range. Because of this lawsuit, California created the Coogan Act in 1939, which required the employer of a child actor to set aside at least 15% of the earnings in a trust, which could only be accessed by the child actor and not the parents. Okay, let's get into the film. So as you can imagine, there will be no audio quips from the film. All the more reason to check out this groundbreaking movie. After the opening credits, the following reads, "A picture with a smile, and perhaps a tear." We then see a woman, played by Edna Purviance, and she's leaving a charity hospital with a newborn baby. And the intertile card reads, "The woman whose sin was motherhood." We're then introduced to the man, Carl Miller, who is the father of the child and is no longer in the relationship with the woman. The woman is distraught with the unwanted pregnancy and decides on a whim to leave the baby in the back of a car and then runs away. However, two men decide to steal the same car with the baby in the back seat. The two thieves pull over on the side of the road and hear the baby crying. Unsure what to do, they simply leave the baby in an alley next to a trash can. Next, we are introduced to our hero, the tramp, Charlie Chaplin, who is always dressed exactly the same in every film. A bowler hat, a baggy, often dirty suit, and a tie, a cane that he twirls, and large fitting shoes, and he walks like a penguin. As usual, trouble always finds him, though through no fault of his. At first, he avoids being hit with garbage tossed out of an apartment ledge, but of course, soon gets hit from the other side with garbage, as the garbage thrower yells, "Awkward ass!" at him. You do not expect to see that in 1921. The tramp is in the same alley where the baby was left, of course. He then notices a woman walking by with a baby carriage, and naturally assumes it's her baby. He says to her, "Pardon me, you dropped something," and puts the baby in the carriage with the woman's real baby. The woman is horrified and tells the tramp to get away. Then, of course, a cop walking the beat sees the tramp trying to leave the baby back where he found it by the trash cans, so the tramp has no other choice but to hold on to the kid. He then sees another tramp and gives the baby to him. The other tramp finds the same baby carriage and puts the baby in it. It's the carriage from the same angry woman. Our main tramp then walks by, and then the woman chases after him, and then hits him over the head with her umbrella and forces him to take the child again. It's absolutely hilarious seeing them argue. So the tramp sits on a curb and comically tries to figure out what to do with the baby. Finally, he searches for the baby blanket it's wrapped in and finds a note. "Please love and care this orphan child." And that's all the note reads. The tramp decides to keep the baby and walks back to his very small one-room apartment where he runs into three women who also live in the building. They ask if the baby is his and what's its name. He thinks for a few moments and replies, "John." We then cut back to the baby's mother, who has now had a change of heart about leaving her son, and is horrified to see that the car where she put the baby is now gone. She races to the house where the car was parked in front of, and explains the situation before fainting. In the meantime, the tramp has found an ingenious way of taking care of John. He creates a pulley system for a makeshift baby hammock, and then converts a tea kettle to a bottle of sorts for the baby to drink milk out of. 5 years then pass, and we are brought back to the same neighborhood, with the same cop walking the same beat. The tramp and John, Jackie Coogan, still live in the same tiny one room, making out a meager life together. The two are best buddies, and John helps the tramp in his business. And by helping, it's a bit mischievous, as the tramp replaces window glass. And John helps by breaking the windows of local places in order for the tramp to conveniently walk by and offer to replace them for a fee. Unfortunately, John gets noticed by a beat cop, and they flee the scene. Well, after a few jobs, their next client happens to be the wife of the same cop that caught them. He is less than pleased to find the tramp replacing their window when he arrives home that day. The tramp and John hilariously run away from the cop and make it back to their room. We are now introduced to the woman from the beginning of the film, who is John's mother. She is now a, quote, star of great prominence, as a popular and wealthy stage actress. However, even though that she is now in high society and has plenty of money, she does give back to the less fortunate and gives away clothes and toys to the needy in poor neighborhoods. Coincidentally, the same neighborhood where John and the tramp live. The woman, while holding a baby in the neighborhood, gazes longingly and thinks about the son she gave up. She doesn't realize that the now 5-year-old boy that is sitting in the doorway near her is her real son. John smiles at the woman and she smiles back. She gives John a toy dog and a ball. She then sighs and walks away. When together in the tiny room, John often assists in the chores and cooking duties, making various items like pancakes for the two. But they have strange eating habits. John, of course, is more interested in eating the syrup by itself instead of the actual pancakes, and the tramp makes almost a burrito with his cakes, which included a chunk of butter in the center. After breakfast, John goes outside to play with his toys that were given to him by the woman. An older kid sees John and steals his toys. John chases the kid and the two get into a fight, while the locals stand around gawking and cheering. The tramp finds John fighting and tries to stop it, but when the locals cry foul, the tramp lets the two kids fight. John actually does really well against the larger kid, often punching him to the ground. It's almost like a professional boxing match, as the tramp takes John to the corner between rounds for a break. The tramp gives him some pointers, but then the older kid's very large and muscular adult brother arrives to find him bawling after taking a beating from John. The brother threatens the tramp by saying, "If your kid beats my brother, then I'm going to beat you." Of course, John mops the floor with the kid. The tramp, wanting to avoid a beating, decides to knock down John and declare the other kid the winner. The ruse doesn't work, and the brother tries to beat up the tramp. However, the tramp is scrappy and much quicker than the larger man, and often ducks and avoids his punches. One of them, which lands on a cop, walking the beat, knocks him out. Finally, the man gets a hold of the tramp, but John's mother happens to arrive in the nick of time and prevents the tramp from taking a beating. However, this is for naught, as the tramp finds a brick and ends up beating up the larger man in a funny way, of course. After many blows to the head with a brick, the larger man stumbles away. However, as it turns out, John is ill and needs to be taken to a doctor. The woman says she'll return later. A doctor comes to visit to treat John. The doctor is a bumbling idiot, and when paired with the tramp, nothing goes right. The doctor then questions the tramp if he's the father of the boy. The tramp replies, "Well, practically," and explains the whole story about how he found him, and shows the doctor the original note pinned to the blanket. The doctor scolds the tramp, saying the boy needs proper care and treatment, and says he'll attend to the matter and leaves. So now the tramp is very worried, but decides to try to help the boy recover any way he can. However, two men from the County Orphan Society arrive at the room and attempt to take John away from the tramp. The tramp tries to fight off the men with help from John, but when a police officer arrives, mayhem ensues and John is taken away in a car. John pleads not to be taken away, but the cruel orphanage people push him in the back and drive off. All the while, the tramp fights off the cop on the building rooftops in order to try to rescue John. He finally jumps into the back of the truck and rescues John, and the two flee on foot. Alright, there's about 10 minutes left, and I can't spoil the outcome. Will John discover who his real mother is, or will he remain with the only parent he's ever known and loved, the tramp? Part of the ending is a bit silly in some ways, but it's amusing as well, and definitely inspired many dream sequences for modern film to come. Now, I realize modern audiences may not be thrilled with silent films, but if you ever want to try out a silent film, Charlie Chaplin films are the place to start. Plus, Jackie Coogan's performance is brilliant, especially for such a young child actor. Look, Chaplin is one of the most gifted filmmakers in the history of cinema. And while you may think you would be bored watching a silent black and white film, I guarantee you will not be. His comedy is absolutely timeless, and frankly says far more with no dialogue than many of the modern films, which are overlong with awful dialogue. Also, even though he's best remembered for his terrific slapstick physical comedy, his films are also very poignant of the times, and often evoke strong emotional and sentimental visuals, which was uncommon for straightforward comedy films. So do yourself a favor and check out Chaplin's films. And the kid is less than an hour. You'll enjoy the ride, I promise you. Alright, some fun facts. The off-screen chemistry between Chaplin and Jackie Coogan was just as strong as their on-screen relationship. Every Sunday during the first few weeks of filming, Chaplin would take Jackie to amusement parks and pony rides and other activities. Some have seen Chaplin's relationship with Coogan as an attempt for Chaplin to reclaim his own unhappy childhood, while others have interpreted that Chaplin's attention towards Coogan was simply his grief about the child he had just lost. As I mentioned earlier, Chaplin found Jackie Coogan performing in vaudeville with his father. The elder Coogan essentially put his career on hold to coach little Jackie through filming. Chaplin, in turn, rewarded Jack Sr.'s role in coaching the boy, as well as stroke the performer's ego by paying him $125 a week, almost double the $75 a week Jackie was getting to co-star. Jack Sr. also played several roles in the film, one as a bum who picks the tramp's pocket, also as the devil in the heaven sequence, and also as a party guest. When Jackie Coogan became an adult, he fell on harsh financial times. In desperation, he reached out to Chaplin, who without hesitation handed him $1,000. For the scene in which the kid is taken from the tramp and nearly carted away to a workhouse, Chaplin stated in his autobiography that the young Jackie Coogan was made to cry by his father, who told him that if he would not cry on the scene, he would be sent to an actual workhouse. Alright, one person that has never seen a silent film, nor a Charlie Chaplin film, is Lindsay. So we get her fresh take on how she feels about this film and Charlie Chaplin and everything else. And then I'll be back next week to talk about yet another random movie, likely with dialogue, at least audible dialogue, from my DVD collection.
Well, I'm not sure we should talk for this one. We should probably do this, well, it'd be impossible for an audio podcast, but this couldn't have been done long, long time ago if we're going to talk about a silent movie.
I guess shame on you for even doing a podcast about this.
Right?
I mean, we shouldn't really be talking.
I don't know how else it would work.
You'd have to do a video for this one.
Yeah.
And then put the little subtitles.
It's like that old NXS video where he's holding up the place cards.
Yeah, we'd have to be doing that. So you're already ruining it, but that's fine.
In any case, so have you ever, did you ever, by the way, welcome Lindsay.
Oh, hi. Hi, everybody.
I think this is the first silent movie you've really seen that is classic.
Yeah, I've seen some of the more like modern
like the artist.
Takes. The Artist. I liked The Artist, yeah. But yes, I've seen the more modern take on silent film. But yeah, this was my first real Charlie Chaplin. I've seen Chaplin, you know, the one that Robert Downey Jr. was in, but that's right. Obviously not a silent film, and that's about him and his life. But this is the first actual Charlie Chaplin film I saw. I was struck by how small he was. He seemed very slight to me, and somehow I just didn't picture that. But yeah, he was a slight man, very physical in his comedy.
Well, even in the, well, it's definitely physical because that's what he was known for. And well, I'm going to quickly look up.
Gosh, you just showed me a photo of him where he didn't have his mustache or anything, and he looks like a totally different man.
He is.
And he didn't have dark hair either.
No.
He had kind of lighter hair in that one photo.
Well, as we were saying, it's really unfortunate, before it became a thing, it really was a Charlie Chaplin mustache. It then became a Hitler mustache, but it wasn't before that, because Charlie Chaplin was much... was way before Hitler.
Well, and Charlie Chaplin really kind of built his character, and it looks like he's only 5'5", so he was, for a man, he is on the slightly shorter side. But yeah, this picture that I'm looking at here from long, long ago, I wouldn't even know that was him compared to his character. So he obviously had a very well-defined character in mind that he wanted to get into, and he did a good job basically morphing into that tramp character, because if you put them side by side, I wouldn't know that was the same guy at all.
Right. Eventually, this was his first full length. He had been for years doing silent shorts, as were the norm back then. And so, even this film, the original cut was about almost 70 minutes long. And so he edited it down, during the re-release to 53 minutes. So it's very well paced, but it doesn't really feel super short. It goes quick. I mean, as it should, but it's like a, you know, almost like a television episode now. The plot is basic. The plot is really just kind of a series of vignettes, which would make sense. So obviously it kept you interested, and you enjoyed, you know, the trials and tribulation of the tramp and the kid.
Yeah, I mean, it physically looked better than I thought it would. It was really clear, and that was nice.
Well, that's Criterion, the way they cleaned it up.
It looks great. Whatever they did, kudos, because it looks amazing, and they did a great job. I thought the story was fairly interesting. It's a sad story, right? Like, you know, from start to finish, there's definitely some like sad elements running through.
Well, it begins
right?
with the mother giving up her
yeah,
child,
just the so. Whole thing is kind of, you know, and then the fight for Tramp to keep the kid, and the kid wants to be with him because obviously he was a good dad. I mean, he may not be the biological father of this child, but he was the only father the child knew, and he was a good dad. He didn't have a lot of money, but they had a lot of fun, and he was well treated. And the tramp does have a house. It's not much to look at,
it's
but
a room.
He's got a roof over his head, and he can keep the kid, you know, fed and clothed and sleeping in a bed and stuff.
Though the way he earns money is kind of funny too.
They are shady. I mean, they kind of like the kid breaks windows and then fixes the windows.
Yeah. Just happens to walk by.
But he kind of get by.
Yeah.
And you got to be, I guess, a little crafty to do this. And they were. I thought one of the coolest things, and I saw it before the movie even started, was that he composed all the music for this. I'm like, wait a second. This guy wrote, starred in, and directed the film. And produced it. Probably edited it, or helped edit it, or whatever. And then he also composed all the music that was included in it. It's just like, what a genius this guy must have been. I mean, that's a lot for any day, even today. And he was doing this in the 20s.
Oh, yeah.
So it really, before the film even started, just seeing that in the early, like, opening credits kind of underscored his genius, because I wasn't expecting that. And I thought, wow, when you really consider how much of the ship he truly captained, mm-hmm. it does make him a very unique talent. And it probably wasn't easy to do all of this in the 1920s.
Well, no, and we saw it like during that scene where he's chasing after the people that are taking the kid, the orphanage, basically, when they're trying to repossess the kid. The rooftop scene, like, that's all real stunts. I mean, they had to time that perfectly. It is really great.
It is great, yeah. And a little bit crazy, because you also have to know that there are the special things that might have happened today to keep them extra safe, like shoes with certain grips or whatever it would have been. It wasn't happening then. Mm-hmm. And so to make the look and feel be what it actually turned out to be, yeah, they basically had to do the stuff. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really have much recourse or any kind of safety equipment or any kind of backup plan.
Yeah.
They just kind of had to do it. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty remarkable, too. The roof scene is the one that is really impressive and kind of scary. But again, his genius just kind of came through this whole thing.
Yeah, and for people that haven't watched silent films, and I get it. Like, it's in black and white, so a lot of people are turned off by that. Two, if there's no audio, they're going to be turned off. But
sure.
Really, you don't need the audio. The way that they are expressive and the way it's actually a great way to watch a film, because it's all, you have to figure it out. Like, it's just kind of implied through the way they act, the way they look, you know, the certain facial expressions they give. And even like the scene where he's in the fight with the kids in the fight.
That was funny.
Too. And that's well choreographed too.
That was actually really humorous.
Yeah.
I liked the scene where they were, you know, doing that, because again, it was, you could laugh at it. I mean, it was funny.
Yeah. I mean, it had a nice, as you said, some of it's very sad, but some of it's very funny. It's kind of like life back then.
And life looked hard back then. It definitely reflected how difficult life was. There wasn't a lot of empathy for anything then. It seemed like a very hard time,
mm-hmm.
like physically hardened time.
Yeah.
And that is, yeah, that's, it's hard to see. I mean, we grew up, what, like 70 plus years or
later,
whatever,
yeah.
After what was it? Yeah, this is the 20s.
Well, it's hard to believe.
As so we were born in the late 70s, so it's like,
as we're recording this movie is 102 years old.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's really
insane.
And
it still holds up, because certain things are timeless. I would say if you're looking to at least watch an older silent movie, I think Charlie Chaplin's the easiest gateway into this. I think he's the most accessible. I know a lot of people like Buster Keaton, but for me, it's I definitely think Charlie Chaplin's the way to go. What other things did you were kind of watching this, and we were mentioning how it seemed like there were a lot more orphans back then, because it was so much easier, or for in a bad way, to basically abandon your kid and had no repercussions
for it. You.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
Mean, it's like today, if you were to,
they would track you.
Then now there are laws, or is it a law? You have the ability, I guess I should say, because I can't say if it's a law,
mm-hmm.
to, if you can't care for a child, like leave at church or firehouse or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. I guess that is a thing. I don't know the specifics.
But you're not going to leave the kid in the,
but
on
it's
the doorstep.
So, now there are cameras. Yeah. There are tracking devices on phone. There's so many ways to
figure
out.
Well, the hospital would have records.
Who did what?
Yeah.
And it was even right from the beginning. She was obviously an unwed woman,
mm-hmm.
who had given birth to this child, you know, out of wedlock.
They weren't doing abortions.
And they
then.
Were, they literally, the scene, they pushed her out of the hospital with the baby and locked the gate right behind her. Basically like, get out of here, filth.
Yeah.
we have lived up to our obligation of making sure you didn't die through this pregnancy. Now get out of here. It was so bad. I mean, I'm sure today it's like not amazing, but also I don't think it's that harsh.
Well, it was. What
I mean, this is a baby we're talking about.
It was the charity hospital.
That's right, what they called the charity it. Hospital. Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is a baby we're talking about. Like, you can't treat an mm-hmm. infant anyway. So, it was very clear how cold it was then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, we talk about Chaplin, how brilliant he is. But really, Jackie Coogan playing the kid, this movie doesn't work without him.
No, he was awesome. What a cute little kid.
Yeah.
I think it's funny that he became Uncle Fester in the Addams Family. But what a cute kid, and he had great acting chops, even as maybe like a 5-year-old or 7 or however old he was technically in the film that he was, not his character. And he was really good.
He was great. And they were so entertaining. Well,
they had a great chemistry between them. I kind of believed it was his kid. I mean, it was a very oddly like heartwarming movie. Even though there was a lot of dark, there was like a lot of positivity in it as well.
Well, speaking of the special effects, could you imagine getting away with, like, they had a real baby.
Where
he's drinking out of the kettle as the bottle.
Like, no. I think that the way that the laws work, you're not even allowed. I don't know the laws, but I will say that I think Hollywood prevents many of the things that he was doing. Like, I don't think you could use a real child for many of those scenes.
I don't know. Maybe.
Now, when she was carrying the baby all wrapped up out, she might have been carrying nothing. Yeah. Like, that could have just been a swaddled bundle of whatever.
Yeah.
But all of the scenes with the infant is the actual infant.
No doubt.
And then the scene with the kettle and everything, that's all.
He was hanging from the little
hammock.
Which was kind of ingenious the way they said
But again, a real child was in that, and I'm not sure they'd allow for it today.
Oh, they did. Again, this is why I think you watch the movie and you're like, wow, this is really well done and well choreographed.
Oh, I mean, it makes it fully impressive knowing that they just, they had to do everything old school. There was absolutely no way around it. If you wanted certain things, you had to just do it. And they did that.
Yeah. And so would this make you want to go back and watch a bunch of silent movies, or at least go back and watch Charlie Chaplin?
I'd probably watch more Charlie Chaplin films just to see what they were like, because I thought that the quality of this one was very high. And honestly, I'm really kind of impressed that he did all the work on this that he did. The fact that he's, I mean, being a composer in and of itself is an incredible talent and remarkable. And some people will wish their whole lives to have a career where they could be doing that kind of work. And he did that in addition to everything else. Yep. It was like a cherry on top of this, which is insane. I mean, he had to be incredibly multi-talented to be able to pull that off. And I saw that in the opening credits before I even saw the film.
Well, look, he is vital to the history of the film. I don't think film goes the way it does without his groundbreaking filmmaking style.
And he had some cool shots and everything in here, too. Like, this was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, for the 1920s, I guess I was very surprised. And again, whomever either remastered or cleaned up this film.
Well, Criterion is the like one of the best when it comes to restoring.
It looked incredible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, so crisp and clear. So whatever they did to improve the quality, it was pretty mind-blowing.
I will wrap up with this. So I don't know where I cut this off for describing the plot, but at the end, there is kind of a fantasy dream sequence that, I don't know, did you, was that, it almost feels out of place, but in some ways it doesn't. Do you think that was necessary, or do you understand why he did it?
It's the only slight detractor to the film, although here's the weird part about it. I can't say I truly understand what it was. My interpretation is that he's dreaming of a better way or a better life. But then the reality is that it's still what it is. Like, they're angels and they're wearing their wings, but they're still fighting. They're still having drama. There's still problems. So I guess my takeaway was, there is no fantasy land. There's only what's now. There's no grass.
Well, it's kind of like we were saying, like your regular dreams, it's whatever happened in your day before, and that's kind of, it mirrored what he just went through.
Oh, yeah, my dreams are always strange reflections of, like, whatever my day looked like manifested. But I think that was the only takeaway. It actually looked really cool.
Yeah, maybe that's why he did it.
It was a very good-looking sequence and an interesting thing. It is a little confusing, but my only thought is that that, in my mind, is what it kind of represented. Like, there is no grass is greener fantasy land. Like, it is what it is, what it is. Whether you dress it up or, you know, it's what reality looks like, you can't kind of escape reality. I don't know. I guess that's how I was looking at it.
Well, I will wrap up with this. My parents definitely know this because they're the ones that told me, but my great-grandmother on my father's side used to play piano at movie theater, movie houses for silent films, and she couldn't even read music. She would just play by ear.
Some people are phenoms. Yeah. I mean, what can you say? They taught themselves, and that still happens. There are still people who never learned how to play something formally or can't read music, but if you put an instrument in front of them, you know, like, or they're like a genius. Yep. They're like a savant. They just know how to do it. Yep. And some people have that ability. This would have been really cool in a theater where someone was playing the organ or whatnot.
Well, we live in the Bay Area, so we're starting to get the Stanford Theater in Palo Alto has reopened. So hopefully they show silent movies. We'll go to that.
Yeah, honestly, it's a really great theater. If you're local to the Bay Area, you should truly check it out. It is really great. And definitely has this old vibe to it. I could see a movie like this feeling.
Have the Wurlitzer playing while they're
going. Feeling like just very classic and traditional and like recapturing the era. So that would be a cool place to see a film like this.
Well, thank you as always, Lindsay, and we'll keep talking. How about that?
Thanks for having me. I hope you guys check this one out. It's worth a watch.
If you enjoy this podcast and are an iTunes user, please do the show a favor and head on over to the official iTunes page for Damn Good Movie Memories. Be sure to leave a rating and a review. This will allow the show to appear higher in the algorithm and spread the joy of this podcast to the masses. If you are not an iTunes user, you can still listen and subscribe on Podbean at damngoodmoviememories.podbean.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook under our Damn Good Movie Memories page. You can also listen to a limited number of episodes on YouTube. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and be sure to tune in next week for an all-new episode of Damn Good Movie Memories.